My guest this week is Michael Gibson, who lives in Athens, Georgia, and who is a senior editor at Lexington Books. He has worked on Paul Schrader and Stanley Kubrick, and we learn why film has been a significant part of Michael's journey, and why he is influenced by Schrader's work on abundant versus sparse cinema. We talk about Schrader's contribution to film scholarship, and we learn why his film Affliction is very John Fordish. Two of Michael's earliest memories are to do with film, including going to see The Empire Strikes Back when he was young and seeing the trailer on TV for The Shining. We learn how the Criterion Channel has kept him sane during lockdown, and he has been watching old Japanese films. Michael was a music buff as a child. He explains why music is a soundtrack to his life and how our musical interests diverge from that of our parents. We learn about Michael's career journey, how he wound up in publishing, and how it keeps him in touch with his research interests and the interdisciplinary scope that that has afforded. He talks about his time spent at Oxford and the different ways that geopolitics was covered in the UK and the US. And Michael talks about it being a life-changing experience. His memories are predominantly positive. And at the end of the interview, we discuss the new normal created by lockdown. And we find out why Michael is both a looking back and a looking forward kind of person. So join me for the latest nostalgia interview. My guest, all the way from Athens, Georgia, via Zoom, is Michael Gibson. So it is absolutely brilliant to have Michael Gibson, and you're in, am I right in thinking, Michael, you're in Athens, but not Athens, Greece, but Athens, Georgia?
That's right. Well, I'm excited to be on the program, so I appreciate the invitation. I am in Athens, Georgia, so that is really close to the University of Georgia. We've been here since about 2011.
And I know that you also do a lot of publishing work, of course, is that right?
That's right. Well, I'm a senior editor. I do environmental studies, Jewish studies, and religion for Lexington Books, which is the academic imprint of Roman and Little People. I've been in academic publishing since 2009, so just a tad under 12 years.
And of course, we have a common field of interest in terms of, well, I work in religion and film, but I know that you have done a lot of work on Paul Schrader and, of course, Stanley Kubrick.
That's right. And I should mention that one of the other reasons that I'm really excited about being able to talk to you is that I read your book, Screen Christology, fairly early in my PhD program at Vanderbilt, and that really was a crucial encounter for me that allowed me to pull together some of these different threads that I work on in religion and film. So I have done a bit of work on Paul Schrader, and I'm currently writing a book on Stanley Kubrick for Rutgers University Press.
Yeah. And how did you get into that? So what, I mean, in my case, I'm going back about 25 years when I did a PhD in the area of religion and film, and the field has gestated, it's moved on so much in that time. In other words, I wouldn't write the same PhD now that I did then, because there are completely different resources available. So I kind of feel I was, you know, at the beginning of that wave, or the second wave anyway. I guess John May and others were very much part of the first one in the late 60s, early 70s. But in your case, how did you end up looking at Schrader and then Kubrick?
So this has been kind of a long journey, and I'm still technically ABD in my PhD program, but film has been a significant part of my journey from really the earliest ages. But as far as Schrader and Kubrick go, I really think that the beginning of examining Schrader and Kubrick really from an academic perspective, that's rooted in the time that I was in PhD studies, around the time I encountered your book, as well as Schrader's book, Transcendental Style and Film. I read that in a seminar with Robin Denson at Vanderbilt and took Schrager's book and wrote a paper on 2001, really arguing that this was an example of a kind of almost apophatic or agnostic version of a transcendental film. And interestingly enough, that is a major theme of the book that I'm working on Kubrick, and one of the chapters is a very significant rerun of some of the material that I wrote in that early paper many years ago.
And do you feel in that sense that Schrader is always worth revisiting? Because I found, particularly in the light of his subsequent film career, obviously working with Scorsese, that's really how I got into my study of Schrader, but then discovering that, of course, he wrote Transcendental Style in Film, that was his PhD, which was published, 1971? And then looking at his film career and looking at the different ways that, you know, he and Scorsese have sort of come together but also diverged. And even in his most recent film, the one that he finally got an Oscar nomination for, the film with Ethan Hawke, that came out just a year or two ago, you kind of feel that there's an obvious thread throughout his career, but it's his contribution to film criticism, I think, that has made people like me, and of course now as I discover yourself, you know, really passionate about doing work, academic work, in this area. So has that been a great influence on you?
Absolutely. And I think, like many people, I really first became aware of Paul Schrader through his screenwriting work. I saw his name keep coming up on these Scorsese films that I really admired. And then found that he had directed his own films, which, I became very interested in those. That had certain similarities and divergences from the work that he did with Scorsese. But it was really, once I got into academic studies and read his book on transcendental film, that I realized that, there's critical theory behind what he's doing. And I actually wrote a fairly long review essay of the new edition of his book. I think it published just a couple of months ago, kind of looking at how his own filmmaking with some attempt to apply the critical theory that he has developed. And of course, with the new edition, one of the things that's really interesting is his attention to the development of slow cinema, which I think first performed is sort of his attempt to answer that offshoot of transcendental style.
Yeah, and I was very moved by that sort of work on sparse cinema versus the great epic films of the 50s and 60s, the Hollywood epics, and the different direction that he went in. So sort of abundant versus sparse, and setting up that interplay and all the paradoxes that come from that. And I think it's very insightful, of course, when he collaborated with Scorsese on The Last Temptation of Christ. You had a film, I mean, even with my students, I still refer to biblical epics, and when I list those, I'll include Last Temptation of Christ in them, and then say, but of course it's not actually an epic, but in a way it's a counter epic, but it's from the same genre. You couldn't have Last Temptation of Christ without King of Kings, but it's the way that, as Scorsese did of course with Cape Fear, he turned on its head all of those tropes and all of those themes, and indeed the style of the biblical epic, and went in a very introverted direction that makes it a fascinating counterpoint to those earlier films. So in a way, it's sort of an epic, but an anti-epic at the same time, and fascinating. And I think that his, Schrader's contribution to film scholarship is so rich, just in terms of the way that he reflects on what Hollywood has done, and then sort of try and regurgitate it in his own style.
Right, yeah, absolutely. The example of Last Temptation is, I think, really apt. And just as Scorsese in other films, really took older Hollywood styles, from the 1940s and 1950s, and sort of ran them through the personal Alabama of, you know, the wave in Italian realism, that sort of thing. I mean, you really can't imagine Last Temptation without the precursors of like the Nicholas Ray type of biblical ethics. And Scorsese is really trying to do his own version of that, and yet it really does stand that genre on its head. And it feels like this sort of hybrid of those kind of biblical ethics, again, runs through that personal type of cinema, which comes out feeling very, very spare. You know, a lot of the scenes in Last Temptation follow the epic template, and yet they're very simple. Not a lot of cast or you know, major set design, which probably part of that was the budget that he was working on, but it has a really incredibly interesting effect on the film itself.
Yeah, and do you find that it's impossible to watch a film now without thinking through some of these tropes, some of these themes, this sort of criticism? Because even, although Schrader is still very much an active filmmaker, I find it very hard to separate the film theory from the film practice. I mean, as you no doubt know through my Facebook posts, I go to the cinema an awful lot, but I find that there's something so insightful, whatever the genre of film, but to sort of ask critical questions about what is that genre trying to do. I suppose Roger Ebert used to try and do that in the Chicago Sun-Times. He'd say, well, what sort of genre is this trying to be? How can you compare it to other films in that genre? And I guess it's impossible when you've done, as we both have, I think, you know, PhDs in similar kind of areas, it's impossible not to be able to apply some of those styles and some of those critical questions to any genre in the same way that Scorsese would look at gangster films but also musicals, but he'd interpret them in a very sort of idiosyncratic way. So sort of Schrader has given us, I think probably both of us, the lens through which we deal with all manner of film scholarship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Schrader is probably the paramount example of someone where within his films, the layer of critical theory is really apparent. Whereas with other filmmakers, it seems more intuitive, or, you know, it's at more of a subconscious level. With Schrader, it really seems that he's working through both the theory and the genealogy. Obviously, with a number of his films, the call-outs to Bresson and Dreyer are very clear. And at the same time, there are other films that I think Affliction might be the most John Fordish of really all of the new Hollywood cinema. So, I mean, Ford was very influential for most of them, Scorsese especially, but Bogdanovich and others. I think Schrader maybe achieved the most John Ford type of film with Affliction. But you can see in his films, I think, a really evident working out of different critical theory and genealogy.
Yeah. And so it sounds as though, not least with the work that you're doing on Kubrick, you know, plenty of opportunities to discover and rediscover old cinema, or not so old cinema. I guess Affliction is now what? It was 98, wasn't it? So, gosh, 22 years. I saw it at the cinema when it came out. How can it be more than two decades old? But just going back a little bit, because I'm fascinated to look at your academic career, but just in terms of, obviously, in terms of the theme of nostalgia, just going back, one of the questions I'll ask later on is whether you ever imagined when you were younger doing the kind of work that you're doing now. And I guess if you're like me, having, well, in my case, I suppose my film passion didn't come until I was at university. So when I was a teenager, before the age of 18, I certainly wouldn't have imagined I'd be doing anything to do with film, maybe radio, but certainly not cinema. That love really started at the university age, and then it took off exponentially. But in your case, what are some of the great things you remember from childhood? Was film, for example, something that was really important to you when you were growing up?
Absolutely. In fact, to two of my earliest memories have to do with film. One of the first memories that I had was actually my parents taking me to the cinema to see Empire Strikes Back. I wound up, that was so enchanting to me. And I wound up with a Darth Vader that for some reason was green. But that experience is the earliest thing that I can remember. The other one, ironically enough, is seeing the trailer for The Shining on TV as a very young kid. And the trailer, if you remember it, is just a single static shot of that famous red elevator bank. And it's held for maybe a minute 20, minute 30 with scrolling title cards. And then at about the minute 30 point, the elevator opens and there's that wave of blood that comes out. And I remember being petrified. And that was my first conscious experience of really images being able to provoke that kind of really deep feeling. Funnily enough, it was a Kubrick thing that did that. But that impacted me from a very early age. I did not see The Shining until I was a teenager. But by the time I did see it, I knew who Kubrick was. But I became obsessed with movies from really about the time that I was maybe 8 or 10 years old. I didn't imagine I would be doing what I'm doing now. That was not really a trajectory that I thought of, but I'm obsessed with movies from early.
Yeah. And do you find that you now revisit, well, I think I know the answer to this, but do you find that you're revisiting all of those films from when you were younger, maybe in new formats, whether Blu-ray or maybe on stream? But do you find that in a high digital format? I think we were in conversation about The Shining, wasn't it, a few months ago, about a new 4K version that was going to be screening at one of your, one of your local cinemas, but certainly a cinema that you were hoping to get to. So there's something very exciting, I find, about being able to revisit those films and almost going back to source. They may be made in analog format, but being able to watch them in high definition in a way that you can't with video for obvious reasons, but going back to the film then being digitized, is such a thrill. And the importance, I do it at the BFI, being able to go back to films that I maybe once saw in a format that now I would dispense with. I wouldn't go back to watching something on video with its its 4:3 screen ratio with all the ends knocked off. But is that something that's quite important to you? But revisiting old films in new formats.
Absolutely, that's to me it's a real treat that both because of the word nostalgia. There's a nostalgic element to it because when I revisit these films a lot of times, it invokes the memory of first seeing them. But with these various formats, especially as we're getting into things like 4K, the details that you see in the new formats, it makes the films new in a certain way, too.
Yeah.
But also to see a number of films, especially older films that I never got to see in theater initially. Being able to see those at like a repertory theater or an art house theater and see them on the screen for the first time is always exciting. Yeah. Of course, we can't do that right now, but
And maybe. Well, absolutely. I was going to ask, because obviously in terms of what's happening with lockdown, how have you managed? Because for me, it's completely changed. It's completely upended my way of life. I mean, not in a way, I'll get over it. And obviously it's only temporary. But have you found that you've discovered new ways of engaging with film, or are you having a bit of a film hiatus?
Well, One of the things that has kept me somewhat sane during lockdown has been the Criterion channel. getting to watch a lot of those films, even though I don't really like watching them on a computer. It's not really the same, but having access to those films when the theater is closed and inaccessible to me, that's been a real lifeline.
Yeah, and I find that perhaps it's just a temporary thing because I have to, but I'm okay with going back to home video or rather watching films on Blu-ray or just in the last few days as I started to run out of the collection that I brought back with me from my office before lockdown, of starting to watch things that I can't watch on Blu-ray but which are available on Amazon Prime, for example. So it's kind of exciting to be able to revisit some of those older films. As you know, I try and review them when I watch them, so and maybe trying to almost like make up for what I didn't do 25 years ago. You know, films that have made an impression on me that I saw 25, 30 years ago, I want to revisit them and I want to concretize them. I want to say something about whether they stood the test of time. Have I changed? Has the film changed in my apprehension? But what you're doing with Criterion sounds very similar. I mean, are there any particular standout films that you've been watching lately on Criterion Channel?
Well, one of the things that I've been doing is watching a lot of older Japanese films. And I actually used to collect those on VHS, you know, like Kurosawa and a number of the samurai films. At a certain point, I actually got into laser discs when I was a teenager. So, you know, and I had a number of Criterion laser discs, and so being able to rewatch a number of things that I had back at that period of time has been interesting. The Criterion channel put out a number of Schrader's films recently.
So a labour of love. It just goes to show, isn't it, that lockdown has in some ways made people far more creative because you have to think outside of the box, you have to do things in a different way. But I have to say, somebody asked me just the other day whether I was planning on returning to the cinemas when they reopen. In Britain, they reopen from the 4th of July onwards, and I have no doubt that I will, because I went through a period of not going to the cinema for about 5 years when my children were young, and I never expected to start going back. I thought that was just something that I did, and you know, I'd move on to other pursuits. But no, with a passion, it's almost as though I have to make up for those missing years. So I suspect I will be back in the coming weeks. What about yourself? Do you find that you know, you're looking forward to returning to going and watching the big screen experience?
I do very much. I think that's one of the things that I miss most. I'm somewhat hesitant about returning when cinemas open here. And in fact, in our state, they are back to being open. But our numbers are on the incline rather than the decline. So I'm a little bit hesitant about doing that. But I definitely look forward to going back when I think I can.
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. And I think for everybody, it's a chance to take stock, reflect, and do things in a different sort of way. I mean, I'm finding certainly at work, I'm busier than ever. And I say at work as if work is a place I go to, which, of course, until 3 months ago, it was. Now, for me, going to work is sitting in my children's bedroom where I am now. And you know, it's a different sort of mindset. In a way, it's harder work because you have to work in a different sort of environment and you haven't got quite the same separation. But somehow it brings out a different set of skills and a different sort of facet, and you have to work to a different sort of set of scheduling or to deadlines, but we'll get there, and by the end of the year I think we'll probably all have found our niche again. But you mentioned film. What about other things from childhood? Music, for example. I was obsessed with the charts. I was obsessed with music when I was younger. My film interest, as I said earlier, took off much later, but were there any other influences like music, for example, maybe reading, that really inspired you when you were growing up?
I was very much a music buff, and I felt very much about music. I think in a way similar to how Scorsese thinks about music, which is music was always kind of a soundtrack for me, and I would hear songs in my head as I was going about my day, or when I would see images, I would hear music. So that was really important for me all throughout my childhood.
Any particular styles? You mentioned Scorsese, so I'm guessing some of the music he used in his soundtracks may have been influential, but are there any particular standouts? Can you remember, for example, what was the first record? If it was a record rather than you mentioned Laserdisc, so all the different sort of technologies we've been through, but in my case it was records. But what can you remember what the first record was that you ever bought?
The first one that I ever bought was probably either Zeppelin or Sabbath. So there was kind of that genre of music, but early 1970s classic rock kind of music.
Yeah, and I found that for me it was far more popular music, but there's something about nostalgia. There's something about the past that somehow it's kind of quality proof. I find that sometimes the music that my children are very young, but the stuff that they might watch on TV, I've got no interest in. I tried once to follow what was in the charts and look at what was number one when they were born, and I forgot immediately because these artists meant nothing to me. And yet, if somebody was born in the 80s, I can say, and often with some degree of precision, not always completely accurately, but I'll say, oh, Diana Ross or the Pet Shop Boys were number one when you were born, and look it up, and I'm certainly perhaps within a month of being right. And it's very interesting because I think it says something about being of a particular age. I think Paul Simon once said that he, whenever he's driving across America, he listens to something on the radio in his car that plays music circa 1957. And of course, in 1957, he would have been sort of mid to late teenage. So again, there's something about that particular age which becomes quality proof. So I guess we all have that. The music we grow up with becomes the music that stays with us. And it's impossible to dissociate that from that kind of growing up. So we kind of are drawn to it, even though perhaps if we were to step back or somebody else from a different generation were to listen, they're going to be a bit more critical of it because they don't have share all the same associations and connotations that music brings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look at the music that I listened to when I was growing up, a lot of that was influenced by, what my parents were listening to, what I heard on the stereo or record player that they would play. But I didn't want to developing my own tape, which I think skewed a little bit towards like punk and metal that they didn't. But it was still largely from the same era that they were listening to. But now I look at the music that was popular when I was a teenager and even into my 20s, and that's now considered classic rock.
It's always interesting, isn't it, when you look at your parents' record collection. I mean, I find that the music that my dad was listening to when he was in his late teenage years is exactly music that I will listen to now in conjunction with the music that I listened to in the 80s when I was that kind of age. So it's as though I grew up listening to his music as well as my music, and somehow it's all fused together. And in some cases, the same artists have appear in both the 50s and, someone like, I don't know, Cliff Richard or someone who was around in the 1950s and then very much when I was, growing up in the 80s and 90s. So I think that you mentioned your parents' music, but in that sense, have you followed very different sort of paths musically or career paths in that sense? What, is there a sense in which there are great differences between what you went on to do and what your parents have done?
I think so. With music, I think we explore different territories. Perhaps the era of music that we gravitated to was similar, but there was certainly a divergence in taste. You know, as far as my other pursuits, like the academy, or in my publishing, there are some differences. I was encouraged in terms of pursuing education and figuring out the path that I could take. Mm-hmm. I think like most people, you know, I did experience some sort of a point where the trajectory sort of veered in one way away from perhaps what, you know, they imagined for me, or, you know, even what I imagined for myself.
And what about getting into academia? Because was that a fluke, a coincidence? I mean, you know, obviously the thing that I find during these interviews is the number of people who are established as academics, but who never expected that that would be where they'd end up. And it's, you know, I guess in some ways you go to university, you do well, you stay in university, you end up not being qualified to do anything else because you've got a PhD, you end up, you know, sort of, well, you've got the PhD, it seems inevitable that you would at least consider following a career in academia. But in your case, how did you end up? You mentioned you did your PhD, and of course you work in publishing, but, and I know that you've done, am I right in thinking, lots of university teaching as well?
Well, yeah, I was a teaching fellow during my PhD program. I didn't actually do any teaching beyond that. I wound up in publishing sort of by accident. I ran out of funding during my PhD program and needed to find full-time work. But I had done freelance editing during my PhD program to, you know, earn some supplemental income, and, you know, thought that that could be a viable path, temporary. And I wound up in a full-time job as an editor right before the previous economic recession in 2008-09. It was an accidental career move, but it was, I think, very fortuitous, because I quickly found that I really enjoyed editing and publishing, and that became the thing that I wanted to do, and I remained in publishing. I think with, you know, the academic side of things, I followed that path largely as self-exploration and development, and it kind of went on. I was going as I was developing different interests. But there was a point at which I realized that I probably would not be an academic professionally. That is, you know, that I would pursue a university teaching course. But, you know, at the same time, the kind of critical skills and the types of things that doing graduate studies really provide you with, there are ways that I can continue to pursue those and employ them. And that's largely been, in the last couple of years, continuing to research and write. And for me, it was really important and valuable that the ability to do these things, like researching and writing in film studies, has been really refreshing, so that I can, you know, really employ the things that I learn and the things that I refine in my graduate work. I can continue to do that while staying in publishing as kind of my vocation.
No, and you must see so many great threads and strands, and, you know, you must have a really good awareness of what people are writing about, how people are responding to particular political, ideological pressures. It must be so gratifying in that sense to be able to have that sense of perspective, which sometimes I find I'm lacking in. I mean, we all have it when, you know, you might find that your students sometimes will recommend a book that you've never heard of, or they might say, you know, they may have come across it by happenstance, but in some cases you can be so locked into a particular area that you're not aware of necessarily all the latest trends and all the latest publications. And so many a time, I've credited my students accordingly, but I've, you know, I'm indebted to my students sometimes for maybe just randomly coming across something. In some cases it might have been a magazine article, sometimes it might be a monograph, or they've got a copy before me. And and so the classroom is a wonderful cauldron for having a discussion around all these latest debates. And it's, you know, although I sometimes from one year to the other might draw on the same lecture material, I might have the same lecture notes, it's never the same lecture, because those notes are always a template for something far wider. But publishing is enviable in many ways, because you've got a real sense, both as someone with the academic background and somebody who knows the field and can see what is the cutting edge material, and of course where your own work fits into that.
Yeah, one of the things that I enjoy most about being in publishing professionally is actually having an acquisitions responsibility for several subject areas, including in my most recent position, I was assigned some subject area that I don't have a background. So, you know, I do environmental studies as one of the subject areas in my current position, and that was fairly new to me. And when I first got that subject area, I went through really for my own sense of being comfortable as an acquisition editor in that area, kind of an orientation process. So delving into the research, the key journals and texts in that particular discipline. Well, I feel like one of the values of being in publishing is this ongoing learning process that oftentimes means that I'm venturing outside of, you know, kind of my own territory, places that I'm really familiar with and comfortable with. That is a really interesting process, and keeps that very fresh. And even in my own territory, you know, that syncs with my background, I do continue to keep, you know, apprised of the journals and new publications. So, you know, there's a way in which that learning is going.
No, it sounds incredibly rewarding, not least for the interdisciplinary scope that it affords you, because, you know, sometimes I find, and I've found it quite frustrating actually sometimes, that my work is known among theologians and people in religious studies, but in film studies, sometimes there's a bit less of an acquaintance. And at work, I remember many years ago going through a promotions committee, and in film studies, they were like, well, we don't recognise any of this material. What's all this stuff on Christ figures and religion and film? And I think there was a very particular lens they were working with. And it was intensely frustrating, because all the sort of religious studies reviewers were able to comment on my research. But it raises that interesting question about how we define ourselves. And sometimes we think we're doing interdisciplinary cutting edge work, but of course sometimes somebody else might be doing interdisciplinary cutting edge work, but the disciplines that they're at the cutting edge of are not the same as oneself. So sometimes you feel that very defensively, and actually it can actually bring up the best research, but you feel very defensively, you have to almost explain your journey, your parameters. And I'm quite sure it's how I ended up doing work in nostalgia, because that whole sense of how did I get to where I am now from where I was before, and in a way part of me wants to tabulate that, to plot that. And I'm really hoping that although I'm known for my work in religion and film, I think the project on nostalgia is going to be a far more personal thing, and I'll see where that goes. But I think it's all good for everyone just to sometimes say, okay, what is the journey I'm on? Is it the right journey? Are there lots of parallel, diverging paths, and how do they interpenetrate with one another? And sometimes that can make you get back on that treadmill, or whatever metaphor is appropriate, and with a new zest sometimes, just to ask that question, how did I end it where I am now? I guess we all do that.
I know exactly what you mean. In fact, I mean, one of the things that I've been very intentional about, especially since I have signed a contract for the Kubrick book, and it is much more in the discipline of film study. I've been intentional about trying to, you know, publish even small pieces in traditional film studies venues. So either, you know, film studies journals, or I just recently did a review of a biography of Preston Sturges for Seneste. So kind of putting out these pieces in, you know, basically visible platforms within that discipline to sort of build up my own presence before the book publishes. Although, you know, I've got to finish it before it publishes. Yeah. But another part of it for me too is over the course of the last few years, I've had that realization as well that for me personally, this is really where I want my work to be. And I have concentrated on that as something that's independent from what I do professionally for my job in publishing. In a certain way, I'm glad that my own work as a scholar and as a researcher and writer has taken the trajectory that in a certain way stands independent from what I do professionally as an editor. Even though, you know, I am drawn on some of those things, especially the background that I have in religion and what I continue to do as an editor in religion, those overlap. But at the same time, finding that space that does sort of stand independently from that has been, I think, really important.
Yeah, I think it's an important counterpoint, which I think is what you're referring to. That sometimes, I suppose it's the equivalent of somebody, and you know, this is a great sort of film script. When you think of Scorsese's After Hours, you know, the office, Paul Hackett, isn't it, Griffin Dunne, by day, he's sitting in an office, and then he goes into this subterranean sort of underworld, and it's sort of the complete opposite of everything about him, but then he returns to his office. I suppose it's the Wizard of Oz story as well, but you know, he's changed by the experience, but there's the sense in which he still needs, his journey requires him, whatever new experiences he's had, to return to some semblance of the day job afterwards. And I think we all need that. I guess I spend my day at work and my evenings at the cinema, and it's kind of a nice counterpoint. But it's good that you can do that with your editing. Otherwise, if it was all the same and you were sort of writing books and reading books in exactly the same area, I guess there comes a point when you just kind of feel you need something different just to refresh yourself.
Absolutely. And you know, especially now, you know, with the events of the last few months, you know, there's this kind of homogeneity of, you know, the day-to-day. And, you know, I feel like there's almost this strange, this extended sense of time during the lockdown that I could see if, you know, I didn't have that sort of, independence or sort of counterpoint in the work that I was doing, that it would become so monolithic, and there'd just be no separation at all.
And it will start to wrap up in a minute with some more philosophical questions, but I just want to check. Am I right in thinking that you were in the UK for a part? I think you told me once that you were for a year or so. Was it at Oxford?
Yeah, I did a study abroad program at Oxford.
Yeah, and any great sort of obvious differences? Because I was interviewing Heidi Campbell the other week, who was at Edinburgh for a long period and is now in Texas, and she was talking about some of the real differences she thought in terms of news, in terms of culture, in terms of politics between the two. So do you have any sort of, you know, great memories of being in Oxford when you were studying?
Oh, it was brilliant. I loved being there. And one of the biggest differences was just this amazing sense of history. Even, you know, particularly just, you know, being in different buildings and surroundings that had immense history, so much more so than you really experience in the U.S. You know, things like going to lunch at the Bear, which is in there since like 900. You know, something like that, you really don't have an equivalent experience here in the U.S. But one of the things that stood out to me when I was there around like news and politics was I was there during the 9/11 era, and there I do remember very distinctly the difference in the way that geopolitics was covered and the way that politics was talked about on the news. That was quite different from the U.S.
And I guess one of the great joys of, I mean, I find it in a far more parochial way, but I still catch up with the news from the part of the world I grew up in. I'm from Wales originally. Now, obviously, Canterbury and Wales are not that far apart, but you know, languages, they certainly are. And I think that one of the great joys is being able to watch some of those programmes, being able to keep up with both, in your case, American and British sort of culture and news. It must be a wonderful kind of, I don't know if hybrid is the right word, but I'm guessing that there must have been something from your time in Britain that you took back with you. Craig Detweiler was saying that in the interview when he spent some time at Cambridge. So I guess in that sense, you know, as we were saying with publishing, there's a sense in which different cultures, different sort of theories collide and interchange.
Absolutely. I think it was a life-changing experience for me. I think it's incredibly important to travel and to experience other culture, precisely because that is something that widens your horizons. And it, the encounter with different ways of thinking, or different ways of approaching issues and discussion, dialogue, is incredibly important. Having an experience with a different kind of healthcare system. So eye-opening for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we won't talk about it now, but certainly I remember my first trip to America and finding, you know, obvious things. Tipping, for example, was the thing, and I was so completely out of my depth. You know, but I thought, well, I've watched all these great American movies. So you're actually there and you think, okay, I need to have a new lens. It's fascinating, and I wish. I think I was about 27 when I got my first passport. I only went to Switzerland, actually, for a film festival. But I kind of feel when lockdown ends, I think I watch so many great movies and I want sometimes to rediscover so much of the world that I feel that, you know, it's when you're losing something, when you haven't got the chance to rediscover something because you're in a lockdown. One of the great incentives and the things to really look forward to is the chance to, with a greater verve, you know, make the most, seize the day, carpe diem. So I hope to be making a few more trips both westwards and eastwards in the coming years. But one thing I just wanted to ask as we start to wrap up, some sort of more nostalgia-based questions. Michael, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
I would think so. Especially my memories of films and literature, those things were really important for me and much, much more deeply formative for me as a person than I think that I realized at the time. But, you know, those things have been remarkably positive, yeah. And continue to be so, you know, as I draw on those kinds of things.
Yeah, and I guess in a way the follow-up question is about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. Would you say that that's possible?
I think so. You know, if we see it as part of the process of, you know, coming to grips with who we are and integrating our experiences into you know, who we are as a person, who we are existentially, who we are emotionally. I think that is possible. If we use the term nostalgia elastically, and, you know, it's not just the sense of longing to repeat certain experiences or preserve those experiences in a particular way, I do think so. I think, you know, especially, you know, as I get older and, you know, I reach middle age, you know, there's a lot of recollection and processing of memories that are both positive and negative, and realizing how much a part of me those are in the negative sense, even if at different periods of my life I tried to, you know, suppress those or, you know, didn't want to remember those, I carry those with me.
Yeah, and I think in a way that's exactly what we do with films sometimes, that it's great to watch a silly Hollywood movie, a blockbuster, but we need that just as much as we need a good art house film. I mean, you know, if you only watch Kubrick or you only watch Scorsese, you know, they're great, but you need to see something else in order to reinforce that sense of what is great. And I guess that applies in all facets of our life sometimes, that we need the trivial, we need the kitsch, we also need the really frustrating, and lockdown is a good way of, you know, for many people asking those questions, what do I need, what are the most important things, because then that reinforces our sense of what really grounds us and motivates us, so that we come out of lockdown perhaps with hopefully a new creative vision. I hope that's the case. I know some people fear that lockdown will lead to, you know, a rise in cases of depression and mental health problems, and that may well be the case. I think for some people, hopefully it'll also be an opportunity for people to say, well, you know, I don't want to go back there, I survived lockdown, but, you know, people will have a very forward creative vision. And it's so hard. Everyone, I think, has got conflicting feelings, and people who used to work in an office will now be getting used to working from home and maybe doing that all the time rather than just doing it occasionally.
Right, yeah, I mean, it certainly seems to be a new normal, you know, in, you know, at least an immediate sense. You know, I saw a report on, I think it was NPR just the other day, about, you know, there really the potential that remote work from home will be permanent for many people. So in a certain way, I hope that this period of time is for many people a time where they are discovering different aspects of, you know, their creativity, different aspects of who they are. Like, you know, there's the space for reflection and contemplation and creativity, particularly in creating a new reality that likely will be with us for, you know, some time to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And my very last question, Michael, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's a good one. I think it's a both and. It's in some ways my background in things like classics and theology do cultivate that sort of looking back kind of thing. I mean, that's, you know, sort of the resources and the traditions that, you know, continue to you know, be resources for us. At the same time, you know, I think just on kind of like personality level, I'm looking for a person. And given everything, I'm intentional about trying to cultivate some kind of hopefulness, some kind of optimism in looking forward.
That sounds so perfect, and a perfect way to end. Michael, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful talking with you, and I'd love to do this again.